Hey, this is Gary K. Wolf, senior reviewer for Locus Magazine, and you're listening to the SF Signal Podcast.
Good evening, Gary.
Well, good evening, Patrick, and good evening, John.
Good evening, Gary.
Okay, so now we have a traditional food streak beginning.
So, Gary K. Wolf, you are the contributing editor and senior reviewer for Locus Magazine, correct?
That's correct.
You also teach at university.
I've been teaching at Roosevelt University for many years, usually not connected to science fiction, but one of the nice things about the university when I started was that they were perfectly happy to have me do critical essays and books about science fiction at a time when some universities thought, what, that? It's been a nice career there. It's been completely parallel to my reviewing career at Locus, which I've been doing for almost 20 years now. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, in your career, you've won a World Fantasy Award, a Pilgrim Award, an Eaton Award, the British Science Fiction Association. Is it association? BSFA?
BSFA is association, I think.
Did they nominate you, or did you also win that award?
I won that one. And I lost one this year. But the BSFA award was kind of distinguished. I've had three books of reviews out, and they've all published by a small press in England called Beckon. The publisher is essentially science fiction criticism. They do my books and John Clute's books, and they've done a couple of other good collections of critical essays, Paul Kincaid's collection. So my books, the review collections, even though they're from Locus, which is an American magazine, have had, I think, more visibility in England than they have here.
Well, that's interesting. And now you've got the Hugo nomination.
The Hugo nomination is my, I'm proud to say, my second Hugo loss. It hasn't happened yet, but the thing is, I also run a small award called the Crawford Award for the International Conference on the Fantastic. And I've learned from the people who have been nominated for that award and not won, and now I've learned firsthand that it's a cliche to say it's an honor to be nominated, but it really is. It means that somebody thought that your book was one of the top books of the year, and it doesn't necessarily... If you think you're actually going to win, it can be very upsetting. You don't want to know in advance whether you've won. You certainly don't want to know in advance that you've lost. But if you go in knowing that there are nominees that are frankly stronger than yours, then you go thinking, this is cool. I get to go to all the parties and stuff. I get to wear the little pin, you know, and I don't have to be on pins and needles during the actual award ceremony.
So this is for your book of critiques. Can you tell listeners how you got started critiquing sci-fi and how it led up to this book?
I started writing reviews for academic journals. I started out as an academic writing articles for journals with titles like Extrapolation and Science Fiction Studies. And eventually there was an old fanzine called Fantasy Review that had been around for a long time in the 60s and 70s. And the editor of that asked me to start doing reviews. And Charles Brown, who is the publisher of Locus, saw reviews there and asked me to start writing reviews in, I think, 1992, in fact. And I said, sure. And he liked them, and I got more and more involved with that sort of thing. Then after several years of doing this, and I haven't even counted up lately, but it's more than 1,100 reviews, some people started saying, why don't you put them together in a book? And essentially, I thought that was a really good idea, but it's a lot of work, and no publisher was interested in it. And then when the publisher of Beckon Books, Roger Robinson, said, why don't you put together a collection of reviews? I thought, this guy's a publisher. I'm going to do that. I'm not going to put together a collection of reviews and send it out there in the mail, but he was very enthusiastic about it. And so I put the first collection together. That's the one that got the first Hugo nomination and the BSFA award. Then the second one followed, which is the one that's nominated for this year's Hugo. And a third one came out in April of this year called Sightings, which is doing reasonably well for a collection of reviews. These things are not going to show up on anywhere, you know, above a million on Amazon, I'm sure.
How many books and stories do you read in a year?
That's an interesting question.
Thank you.
I guess, well, I could calculate it because for the column, I'm doing probably 4 to 6 books a month, which is, 48 to 70 or something that I have to review. And I try to give myself a week to read stuff that I just want to read, which may not, maybe other science fiction I haven't caught up on, maybe my magazines, anything, and to try to squeeze in. So I'm guessing between the stuff I'm reviewing and the stuff I'm just reading, 80 or 90 books, maybe. I don't know. I know people who read a book a night, so I'm not keeping up with them.
So I have a question. What's the difference between, in your mind, what's the difference between a review and a critique, and what should each of them strive to do?
I think I have a simple answer for that. You're writing a review for a readership that has not read the book, and in some cases that may never have heard of the book. And so you're trying to essentially give them enough information to let them decide whether they want to read the book or not. I'm not a strong believer in saying you must read this book or you must avoid this book, because different readers have different tastes, and my reviews reflect my tastes. When you're writing a critical essay about a book, you assume that your audience does know the book. You assume that they've read it, that they're familiar with the allusions in it, and you're trying to point out things that they might not have seen before or to connect the book to other books they might not have connected them with before.
Why write a critical review, though? I mean, I'm always fascinated by the fact that you can sit there and read something and see maybe a subtext that I'm not picking up on. But I mean, what led you to start doing that? Why write the critiques?
Well, first of all, I love to read them. Are you talking about the critical essays or
yeah,
the review?
The critical essay.
The critical essays are sometimes a way of connecting a lot of different books in terms of an overall thesis. For example, I was one of the essays in this new book of essays of mine, dealt with the relationship between historical fiction and science fiction. And sometimes you have to read a lot of books to see a pattern emerging there. There's a lot of science fiction and fantasy that's invading the territory of what we used to think of as historical fiction. And if you see one person doing that, it's quirky. If you see a bunch of people doing it, it's a trend. And steampunk eventually got a name, but people have been talking about sort of steampunky books for a long time before that came together. So what you're doing, you're trying to find patterns in all the books that are out there. Some of them are really terrific books and some of them aren't, but one of the things about a critical essay is you can write about a book that doesn't really work very well and show why it's still an important book.
So the ability to be able to recognize trends is a result of how much you read. So essentially, the more you read, the more informed you are about the genre, and the more you can make those connections.
I think so. I think you can help people see that there are patterns out there. You can help people find what is it that interests them about particular books that they may not have connected with particular other books, and so forth and so on.
Someone knocking at the door there?
Actually, there's. I'm in downtown Chicago, and occasionally, odd noises come in from outside. That is either someone hammering a fence post or shooting somebody else. I'm not sure which.
Oh my gosh! I hope it was the fence post.
No, I think that the gunshots would have been louder than that. I don't very often get gunshots here.
So is there such a thing as a bad review? I mean, is with all the proliferation of genre blogs out there and all the reviews happening, I mean, you know, some people write better reviews than others, and some reviewers see fit to take some writer to task for some reason, like they have some hidden agenda or whatever. Is there such a thing as a bad review?
I think you just defined a bad review. A bad review is essentially somebody who wants to call attention to themselves rather than to the book. And one of the criticisms that I've heard more about Locus magazine in general than about myself is the lack of negative reviews. Okay, that's a guy with a fence post, so just ignore it. Ignore the man. Fact is that if you really, really dislike a book, why do you bother finishing reading it? You don't have to. I mean, by and large, at Locus, I am not given a book and told I have to review it. I'm sent a bunch of books. I'm sent way more books than I can possibly review. And essentially, what I'm going to do is start a book, and if it grabs me in some way and pulls me through, then I'll probably write a review of it. But if I can't finish it, or if there's something that I think this thing is just a disaster, I'm not going to finish the book, and I'm not going to write a review saying why I didn't finish the book, because that seems to me to be unfair to the writer and unfair to the reader of your review. The easiest review in the world to write is a killer review. They're more fun to write. You can be funny. You can be witty. You can demolish this poor writer. And the people who start up reading a book, start off reading any book in order to find out what's wrong with it, strikes me as people who don't have a kind of passion for the genre to begin with. And I do know people like that, and I have seen reviews like that. So, yeah, I don't think the purpose of review is to destroy somebody's career. And I think people who write those kinds of reviews, I've written negative reviews. Don't get me wrong. I've written negative reviews when a book has a high profile and in some cases is, I think, just seriously, possibly damaging or maybe even has moral problems with it. And I won't mention any names there. But when you've got a book which is reasonably ambitious and reasonably successful, and after a while you think, okay, I'm spending a week, you know, reading and reviewing this book that some author, sometimes a first novelist, spent 4 or 5 years on, and do I really have the authority or the right to just demolish everything they spent that 4 years doing?
Wow. Do you ever read outside of genre?
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to say, just to add a little bit to that, you know, you say that you get more books than you can ever read. I am on the tip of that now through Functional Nerds. We get a lot of books, and I know that John gets a billion books for SF Signal. I can only imagine how many you receive. Do you still go out and buy a book for pleasure? When you're not, do you ever, I guess what I'm trying to say is, do you go out and buy a book for pleasure? Do you ever buy anything outside of genre? And when you get something like that, does your mind just let you read it, or do you start writing the review in your head?
No, I don't start writing a review. If I'm reading, I read an occasional mystery novel, for example. I used to be a big fan of Robert Parker's, and I like Elmore Leonard novels when I can, you know, find time to do them. And no, the reviewing mechanism kind of turns off because I can see myself just having fun with it. And this is where I'm very happy with my Kindle. I mean, there are things that I don't like about reading books online, but you can download sample chapters. You can read lots of bits and pieces of other books. Having a Kindle is like being able to go into Barnes & Noble and sit there and read for hours. But I think it's important for most science fiction and fantasy readers these days to do some reading outside genre because so many of the writers are doing reading outside of genre. And there are endless examples. When Joe Haldeman does a riff on Hemingway, you need to know Hemingway. When Gregory Benford does a riff on William Faulkner, which he's done, you need to know that. When Peter Straub does a Herman Melville story, which he did, you're missing a huge chunk of the experience of that story if you don't know the mainstream literature that it alludes to.
And you get points for mentioning Spencer.
I actually knew Robert Parker.
I know. I've heard that on the Coot Street podcast.
Right, and he was a delightful guy, and he was. I identified him because he's a guy who got a PhD in American literature, and was well on his way to being a professor. He'd studied Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett and Ross Macdonald for his dissertation, and suddenly he was writing these boring articles like I was writing, you know, for academic journals, and thought, wait a minute. I know how to write these novels. I've studied them. I figured out the structure. And he just took all the stuff from his academic work and poured it into creating Spencer and then Hawk. You know why Hawk was created? I know we're talking about mysteries now. Because he realized that every major hero in American literature had a non-white companion.
Tonto. Going back,
Tonto.
Kato.
Natty Bumppo. The Lone Ranger in Silver. Even Kato.
Yep. Green Hornet and Kato. Now, it's interesting, though, that you do mention Hawk, because I remember a quote years ago when the TV show was still on. So they wanted him to write Hawk novels. Uh-huh. And I remember a quote where he said something along the lines of, I'm not going to do that because I am not Hawk. I did not grow up as a black man in the inner city.
No, and he was very well aware of that, and he was he had friends, he had a character that he. Oh, I just got a note. Silver was the horse. Tonto was okay.
Yes, right. I mentioned Tonto and Kato.
Okay, and Kato. So at any rate, he didn't want to try to represent a culture and a background and upbringing that he didn't know, but as a kind of companion to Spencer, he knew how to write characters like that because he knew a guy like Hawk. So what he was doing in writing Hawk was writing a character based on somebody he knew, but not somebody he was. But that's the kind of thing that writers can concern themselves with. I mean, he started a second series of mysteries about this Jesse, what's his name, the small-town sheriff in Maine. It's a series of movies with Tom Selleck now. And he told me that he started writing that because he just for once wanted to write a novel in the third person. It's something as simple as that. And writers often think about things like that. Sometimes, this is one of the things that always surprises fans when they finally work their way into going to dinner with lots of writers and they become familiar and they think, wow, it's really cool. I'm going to be talking to famous writers now. And they expect intellectual, artistic discussions, and what they get are complaints about contracts and editors and print runs and advances.
Gary, you mentioned the Kindle before. Do you find yourself reading? I mean, you read obviously reading some books on the Kindle. About how many books, like percentage wise, are you reading electronically versus physically?
Well, okay, here's another problem of being a reviewer that has to have a book basically written up 6 weeks before the.
Yeah.
So I can't look at a finished book on a Kindle. If a book is available on Kindle, it's too late for me to review it for Logan's. What I find the Kindle very useful for is sometimes I'll get a book in manuscript. If I'm traveling around going to a convention or something, I've got a 500-page manuscript. That's a nuisance. I can email the manuscript to my Kindle account and it shows up on my Kindle, and that's enormously convenient. And the books I buy on my own, I've been tending to buy on Kindle.
How prepared do you think publishers are for e-books? What's the current state, would you say?
I think the initial crisis is over. The initial crisis is that no publishers are saying it's just a passing fad anymore, and they're realizing they have to deal with this. I've noticed that there are writers who I know that find themselves selling better on, well, not just on Kindle, but on Kindle and Nook and the Sony Reader and so forth. But the electronic sales are now very, very substantial. And I think the other thing which is happening, which may be more of an advantage to writers than to other publishers, is the degree to which Amazon's moving into publishing. I know a number of writers who are putting their backlist up on Amazon or on Kindle and getting sales that they would never have gotten otherwise. This is a book that would not come back into print. And now they're getting a kind of steady stream of income from books that in previous years you'd have to go back to a publisher and beg them to please bring it back into print. And characteristically, the publishers would talk to the distributors, they'd talk to Barnes & Noble and in the recent past, at least, Borders, and the sales figures wouldn't bear it out, and so the book would never get reprinted. Now the book can get reprinted and can sell 30, 40, 50 copies a year, but with the author getting 70% of that, if you get enough books out there, that's an income stream.
And that's a huge point to make, because a lot of authors are talking about the fact that they can pull it up on Amazon, they can see what they've sold, and they can actually see the money that they're going to be getting at the end of the month.
Absolutely.
And that's huge.
It is, and it's especially huge for writers who are old enough to remember the earlier days of publishing, when sometimes you could never find out from the publisher how many books they actually sold, or in some cases, not even find out from your agent where it had been sold. There was a friend of mine, I probably shouldn't mention his name because the agency he was working with still exists, but he switched agencies a few years ago. And he was a very well-known science fiction. Okay, I'll say his name. It's Philip Jose Farmer. He switched agencies, and after he switched agencies, within a year, he found out that books of his had been sold in Eastern Europe that he'd never even found out about.
Wow.
He had a bunch of back royalties just waiting for him that it had never gotten from his previous agency.
That's crazy.
So now you're absolutely right. With Amazon, writers don't need to depend on anybody telling them this. They can look it up themselves. I don't think in general, I don't think ebook publishing is going to replace mainstream publishing, but it's not going to go away, and it's going to go on getting bigger and bigger. Back in the 19th century, people who bought novels were kind of the elite, the upper classes, the people who had money to buy novels. Other people would buy tabloid newspapers or serials, and you know, Dickens was serialized in newspapers, Poe published in newspapers, and that sort of thing. That was kind of the mass market. And that mass market is now all electronic. And it may be that book publishing, in the sense of going out and paying $35 for a new novel, which some of them are now, is going to shrink. It's going to become the people who have the $35, and everybody else will buy the e-version. And I discovered that my new book, it's called The Backreading Genres, is now available on Kindle and Nook and that sort of thing. Now, this is a university press book, which they're generally pretty overpriced. And I thought, well, wait a minute. My first thought was, I'm not going to collect, I mean, because it's $11.95, I'm not going to collect as many royalties. But then I thought, if it's $11.95, a lot more people are going to buy it. Right? If you're seeing that, too.
Yep. Now, we would be remiss if we didn't mention, you said that you started writing for Locus in 91, so that's a 20-year relationship.
Right.
That began with Charles Brown, continues today, and you also have a long friendship with Jonathan Strawn, and that led to the Cood Street podcast.
Absolutely. It's something I think everybody experiences in this field, that you have, it's one of the reasons people go to conventions. You have your set of friends and family who think you're just weird for reading this stuff, and you can't talk to them about it.
Yep.
I've got my friends at the university who think I'm weird for reading this stuff, and I can't talk to them. So you begin to, you go to conventions so you can talk to people about the books you've read. When I was working with Charles Brown, he and I would talk once a week, if not more, well, usually quite a bit more. And just about science fiction, he had this idea that science fiction was a philosophy. It was a philosophy that could change the world. He was one of the true believers who grew up. He was one of the guys who read Heinlein Juveniles when he was a juvenile, and when they were brand new. So, and Charles passed away rather unexpectedly about 2 years ago, or I think it was 2 years ago. And by then, Jonathan and I had become friends, because Jonathan is the reviews editor of Locus. And Jonathan had been having these same conversations with Charles. So Jonathan and I started, we'd been talking to each other, but now it became a kind of gap to fill in, where you want somebody to talk about what you've just read. And in the case of being in a reviewing agenda where what you're reading is like usually 2 to 3 months ahead of what everybody's reading, there are only a few people you can talk to about it. And so Jonathan and I would be talking about what I'm reading right now is a new Neal Stephenson novel, which nobody can pronounce the title of.
I read that as Read Me, but it's not, is it? It's Reamd or something, isn't it?
It's Reamd, but the title comes from a typo in a massive multiplayer online game. One of the programs typed Reamd instead of Read Me, so that's where the title comes from. I still don't know what you're supposed to. I still don't know how you're supposed to pronounce it.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, that's what I tend to be reading right now. So, frankly, if I'm talking to most of my friends who are fans, of course they're not reading that right now. And so there are very few people that I can sort of compare notes with about stuff that's not going to come out for another month or two. And Jonathan is great at that, because Jonathan's reading all the short stories of the year months before anybody else does.
Now I'm picturing this elite country club of reviewers sitting around with their smoking jackets and talking about the books that are going to be out in like 9 months. I just have this image now.
People all live in New York and they don't read science fiction.
and just a shout out for any of our listeners out there who haven't listened to the Cood Street podcast. I find that to be one of the most eminently listenable podcasts. The wealth of knowledge that any one of you have is amazing, and just to listen to both of you talk about it together back and forth, it's like a ping pong match of things I want to know more about. Everything you throw back at each other is just and you guys have great rapport together, and it's just fun to listen to. So check that out.
Yeah, that's delightful. We started talking because, well, we'd been talking anyway, and Jonathan said, why don't we record it? And we did, and started getting some response to it. Actually, the Cood Street podcast got nominated for a VSFA award, which stunned both of us, because neither one of us are British.
Well, you had Tansy on.
Yeah, that's true. We had Tansy on, and I guess a lot of our listeners seem to be in the UK. There's an odd thing about the UK. I'm envious of the UK science fiction and fantasy community because it's very energetic, and all the different groups that are separate groups in the States are not separate there. And I gather the same thing is true in Australia, but in the States at least, and I don't know if you guys have seen or felt this, or maybe you haven't, you probably haven't been involved much in the academic world of science fiction, but its own little group. It has the Science Fiction Research Association convention, which is mostly what it does. And a lot of those people don't talk to the fans, and the fans have their own fan conventions, and there are very fanish fan conventions, as you know. And then there are the kind of what I think of as semi-professional conventions, the ones which are half or more writers and editors and agents. And those three communities only seldom overlap. And it seems to me that in England, they're virtually the same people. Hmm. You know, the academics are fans, and they're also writers. I mean, Jeff Ryman and Graham Joyce are teaching at universities, and other people like Edward James and Tara Mendelson, who teach at the universities, are involved in the fan community. And they all kind of know and get along in a way that I don't see happening in the States as much.
Well, and I wonder, because a lot of times when I look at the UK, I feel like science fiction and fantasy is more acceptable there than it is here.
I think that's true. And again, when you mention people who write major reviews for major newspapers like The Guardian, you're going to see reviews by people like John Courtney Grimwood or John Clute. And I don't think that the Washington Post is the only thing in the United States that comes close to that. Because the Washington Post has Michael Durda, who's very sympathetic to science fiction and fantasy. They'll run reviews by Elizabeth Hand or Paul Park. And so they have really intelligent reviewers. And in the last couple of years, we've been very lucky to have Lev Grossman at Time Magazine, who has done a huge amount to bring to a much broader base of attention people like China Mieville and Paolo Bacigalupi.
So we talked briefly about conventions. I know you're going to ReaderCon.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any other conventions that you look at throughout the year and think, you know, oh gosh, these are the ones I really want to go to?
Well, there's one I've been going to forever, which is in Florida, called the International Conference on the Fantastic, which is one of those. It's probably one of the major conventions to bring together academic critics and teachers of science fiction with writers. There are relatively few fans who come there as fans because there's not much fanish activity. I like that. I like ReaderCon because I go to conventions to see friends. I like ReaderCon, and I like World Fantasy a lot because there's a high proportion of people that are just a lot of fun to talk to. Worldcons I'll go to occasionally, but they're just massive. And the way I treat a Worldcon is that somewhere within this mass of costumes and folk singing and media and gaming and so forth and so on, there's a little miniature convention going on about books. And find those people and we can talk about them.
Have you noticed any trends in conventions over the years?
Mm-hmm. Worldcons, I used to report on Worldcons for Locus. And what I did for about 5 years in a row was I would tot up the number of program items and divide them up according to what the topics were. Because the first Worldcons I went to, and I've not gone to a lot, maybe 7 or 8, but the first ones I went to were in Chicago maybe 20 years ago. And they were very heavily science fiction fan conventions. There were the groups among the Worldcon attendees were the Analog Group and the Literary Group and the Satire Group and the Douglas Adams Group and so forth. Then I noticed what happened was the number of program items that dealt with books, with literature, was shrinking in comparison to the number of program items that dealt with media, gaming, television, and con running. One of them I remember, I don't remember which one it was, it may have been Balticon. Actually, the largest number of program items at that Worldcon was about how to be a fan. If you look at how to be a fan, it's including filking and costuming and con running and that sort of thing. And the second largest group was movies and TV, and then the third largest group was literature. And so that's the trend I've seen, is that literature has become the minority of program items in Worldcons. Now, that depends on where the Worldcon is. The Glasgow Worldcon in 1995, I think, was very literary, but that's UK cons tend to be that way.
It's interesting that you say that because last year's World Fantasy, you know, I was looking at that, and John and I went, and I was actually shocked at how little media stuff was included. You know, I fully expected to see some podcasters there podcasting or something like that, and there was nothing like that I saw going on. So that kind of shocked me.
Yeah, World Fantasy is very literary oriented, and ReaderCon's very name says this is a convention for readers, period. And so there's almost no discussion. I mean, I have no objection to media programming at all. And you go to something like DragonCon, and it's just overwhelming. And if you go to something like Comic-Con, it's way more overwhelming.
Now, you couldn't pay me to go to Comic-Con.
I wasn't going to offer, actually.
You know, there's a couple of bookstores here in Denver that are kind of world famous. One is Tattered Cover.
Yeah.
The other one is Mile High Comics. And I remember growing up, you know, reading comic books, and there was always the ad in the back of the comics for Mile High Comics, which is the store here in Denver. And I want to say 2 years ago, the owner went to Comic-Con, and when he came back, he said, "That's it, I'm done." He says, because it's not about comic books anymore. He said, "You used to be able to go to Comic-Con and sell comics and see comics and read comics, and you could go through boxes of comics." He said, "And now you go there, and it's all about Hollywood."
I think that's true, and I went to one small Comic-Con last year here in Chicago, and it turns out that this was a Comic-Con that was intended to shift the focus back to comics. There were a lot of comic dealers there, but the reason I went was a friend of mine who's a very well-known writer, Peter Straub, had written his first graphic novel with his friend, who's an actor on One Life to Live, called Michael Easton, and they were there, you know, under the aegis of, I think, Vertigo. And what struck me as being interesting was that you go to a convention, you go to any literary convention pretty much in the world with Peter Straub, and he's going to get noticed. He got introduced to the audience by the president of Vertigo, I think, saying, "You probably don't know this next writer, but he's one of our leading prose writers in the country." And I thought, okay, a prose writer is kind of an odd bird for these people. This is somebody, he practically had to explain to the audience that this guy actually writes words on pages without pictures. And the audience is saying, "Oh, geez, what a concept."
You know, there are comic book companies now that are trying to put out novels.
There are some. I know Liz Hand had a book of short stories published by, I think, M Publishing, which was it was a division of some comic book company a few years ago. And I don't know how well that's doing. Do you have any sense of what their level of success is?
I remember there was a guy running around World Fantasy. Do you remember that guy, John?
No.
He was pushing a new novel, and I want to say it was coming out from DC, but it was an original fiction novel.
Hmm.
But I haven't heard anything more about it. You know, I mean, you get your normal like tie-ins. I know Tracy Hickman's working on a Batman novel. You know, you get somebody working on a Superman novel or a Spider-Man or this or that. But they were actually trying to push original fiction not based on comic characters. And I don't know how that's going. Obviously, it's not doing gangbusters because none of us have heard of it.
No. And I think one of the things that was very tempting about the idea is that they seem to have a great distribution system. I mean, comics get distributed like wildfire. The problem I saw was that comic book shops are not the places you're going to sell prose novels. So I'm not sure their distribution system is as powerful as it originally seemed. I think a much healthier, a much more likely trend is, you mentioned writers from our field, good writers in our field, like Chris Roberson, moving over into comics and adding a more literary dimension to things like Superman. I think that's perfectly healthy. The only problem is that when Chris moves into something like that, or Sean Stewart moves into gaming, or any number of writers were involved with I Love Bees, then you think, well, does that mean we're not going to see any more novels from these people?
Yeah.
Like reading their novels.
I don't think so. I think it's just, you know, it's like you were talking about how you sit down to dinner with an author and, you know, they're complaining about contracts. The other thing that they talk a lot about is, you know, trying to stay fresh and do different things. And, you know, Chris wanted to write Superman, so he's getting to write Superman.
Absolutely. And anybody who grew up reading Superman, that's got to be a dream come true. And he's having a blast from what I can tell.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, I think is it Daryl Gregory doing Planet of the Apes comic?
Oh, is Daryl doing one? Oh, that's great.
I think so, yeah.
Well, also, to be honest, the kind of money that you're looking at with comic contracts is pretty impressive compared to what most first or second or third novel contracts are. The thing that concerns me a little bit is you get writers that I think who have very individual voices. And I don't begrudge anybody doing something that will, you know, make a decent income for them. But Daryl writes very unusual novels. They're very, very good novels. But they're not broadly commercial in the sense that that a Michael Crichton novel is, for example. And I guess what I'm saying is I would rather see writers like that work with comics where they're not using different muscles than to have them decide, okay, I am now going to write a mainstream thriller bestseller and not do a very good job of it.
Well, and it's interesting that you say use different muscles because it is different to write a comic. I think it was Holly Black was talking about, you know, when you actually write a comic, you're working on a graphic novel. You have to be aware of, you know, you're essentially describing panels.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to know this is where they're going to turn the page, you know, and then what's going to be in the top panel, what's going to be in the bottom panel, what's going to, you know, it's a completely different way of writing.
Yeah, and the only procedure of that I followed through was when Peter was working with Michael Easton on the Green Woman, and Peter had no idea how to write comics, so he wrote a story. Michael would turn the story into segments and panels, and then they send the whole thing out to John Bolton, who was a very high profile artist. They send everything out to Bolton, and he would sort of redesign things again, where there would be a whole page. I'm not plugging that figure because I don't know what it's up against with Green Novels, but there were whole pages of Bolton's art that would carry the story. And I couldn't figure out how that got that way, but I thought, that's impressive. It's an impressive piece of work, which is a completely different art form from writing a piece of prose fiction.
And absolutely.
I just don't know enough about it. I don't begrudge people who read nothing but graphic novels, because I remember years ago when I read Mouse, and it won I think, a special National Book Award. And actually taught that in class. And then I met Neil Gaiman, introduced me to Scott McCloud, who has written one of the best critical books of any sort I've seen in 20 years called Understanding Comics. And it completely led me to believe, okay, this is an art form which is not art and it's not narrative, but it's both. And it's more than both. And I had enormous respect for that. I just am a little bit ignorant of it.
Now, I've taken you a little bit over the time that I had set aside for you here. I promised I'd get you out a little bit early. Why don't you tell folks now, do you have a collection coming out soon?
Not immediately. I had a collection coming out in April, which is the third collection of reviews called Siding, which is from Beckham Press. And at the beginning of the year, I had a book called Evaporating Genres, which is a collection of not reviews, but critical essays about science fiction, fantasy, and horror. And both of those are available on Amazon now, I guess.
Okay, and did you also have something on Philip Jose Farmer?
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that. Mediterranean Press published Up the Bright River, which was a collection of, the first posthumous collection of Philip Jose Farmer stories, which was a challenge. It was a delight and a challenge to do. Phil was a very good friend who died a couple of years ago. And The Subterranean has already published the best of Philip Jose Farmer. And my challenge was to find another bunch of stories that had not been published in the best of Philip Jose Farmer. And I spent a lot of time finding stories that most people have never heard of, including the only River World stories that he actually wrote, that were short stories, and a couple of his Lord Greystoke Tarzan pieces that have not been reprinted. So that's, if people are interested in Philip Jose Farmer, that's a collection of largely unknown pieces, but some really good ones.
Very cool. Now you have the Cood Street podcast with Jonathan. Is there anything else online that you want to tell people about? Website or your Twitter or your Facebook, anything like that?
I'm on Twitter. I've got a Facebook page. My own website is kind of in tatters right now, and I need help working on it. But that's just a university website, and they changed servers, and they changed the server I know nothing about. Occasionally, I've been on the Locus Magazine podcast with Karen Burnham, or on one of the Locus Roundtables, both of which you can find at locusmag.com online. And apart from that, I'm just doing the review column and hoping I can get through. Let's see, I've only got 850 pages left of this Neil Stephenson novel. I'm doing well.
You know what I just opened last night?
What?
Jeffrey Deaver, I think is his name. It's Carte Blanche. It's the new James Bond novel.
That sounds like fun.
That's why I picked it up, because it's different. I've never read a James Bond novel before. I've heard that the Ian Fleming novels are completely different from the movies and are supposed to be really, really good. And this is written in that tone.
I'm partial to Rex Stout myself.
Oh, Rex Stout is... If we have another half hour, Rex Stout is one of those mystery writers. You would be amazed at how many science fiction writers are Rex Stout fans.
Oh, Effinger, George Alec Effinger had a little bit in one of his Budayun stories. One of the Maureen, what was his name? Maureen Audrey.
Or yeah,
Maureen Audran or whatever his name was. Yeah, in those stories. Those were good. I kind of like in Rex Stout and his writing style. To me, it feels like the mystery version of Sturgeon. It's sort of stylistic. It really feels like he's having fun doing it, and it's just a hoot to read. Lots of fun.
They're a lot of fun. There was a guy here in Chicago who actually wrote a couple of authorized Rex Stout novels years after he died, some Nero Wolfe novels. And they weren't quite as good, but they're just terrific mysteries. I mean, the mysteries all work out in a classic sense. And I think writers who want to learn discipline and plotting and that sort of thing. I mean, I could go on. I'm a Rex Stout fan myself. One quick observation is one of the things I think that made those novels so important in the 30s is that they were a transition between the classical sit-at-home detective, the Sherlock Holmes detective, who's Nero Wolfe, and the hard-boiled, Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler detective, who, of course, is
Archie Goodwin, yeah.
Here's where I always make Karen Burnham roll her eyes and go, my God, how much television have you watched? I grew up watching mysteries with my grandmother, and she always watched Masterpiece Theater. So we would get Miss Marple, and we would get Hercule Poirot, however you say that, Poirot. We would watch Charlie Chan on WGN. The old movies, Sherlock Holmes. I mean, all that kind of stuff. I grew up watching Agatha Christie. I mean, you name it, all that with my grandmother.
Oh, if she's still around, give her thanks, because that's a rare privilege. I mean, one of the things I think is fascinating about people who read science fiction and fantasy and horror and mysteries is how you get into it. And there's a huge amount of mystery reading in the backgrounds of an enormous number of writers that I know.
I don't doubt it.
Stout is right there. And Sherlock Holmes, in a sense, you go to Sherlock Holmes and Edgar Allan Poe before that, they were writing stories which moved like science fiction stories. They were writing stories about a very confusing, hostile, dangerous urban universe where problems can be solved through rationality and science. It's essentially what science fiction said from the beginning.
Yep. Well, like you said, if we had another 2 hours, I'm not going for half an hour. If we had another 2 hours, we could just continue talking about this, and I think everybody would just love it.
This is a lot of fun. Thank you.
But yeah, I want to thank you for coming on. This has been huge. We really appreciate you taking the time to sit down and chat with us.
Okay, I'll look forward to doing it again sometime.
As you can tell, John and I had a lot of fun with that interview. We are fans, and you should be checking out the Cood Street podcast, and you should have a subscription to Locus if you don't already. Those two things, I mean, if you listen to the Cood Street podcast, you will get just a ton of information about books and
science fiction, and I mean, and just, you know, all the, it's, if it's nothing else, the price of admission, the stories is worth it. So definitely check that out. Thanks for listening. I know this has been a little bit longer podcast, but hey, you know, it was great. So there. You should be following John D on Twitter, twitter.com/sfsignal. If you're looking for me, I am ATFMB, so twitter.com/ATFMB or ATFMB.com is my blog. SFsignal.com has great content each and every day, from mind melds to movie trailers to the Tuesday tune. You name it, it's on there. Tons and tons of stuff. Lots of contributing articles from our SF Signal crew. And, of course, SF Signal just turned 8 years old, so happy birthday to us. If you have any thoughts, comments, suggestions, anything like that, feel free to give us a call on the voicemail line, 720-277-9082. Google runs that, and once you call in, you've got 3 minutes to tell us what you think. I think that's pretty much it for me. It's Sunday here, so I'm looking forward to both True Blood and Falling Skies. And In Plain Sight, but that's not SF Signal. I mean, that's not science fiction. But Falling Skies getting really, really good. And I don't want to spoil anything for anybody, but if you live in a post-apocalyptic world and a guy comes out of nowhere, even a guy that you know and you trust, and he tells you, hey, I want to take your kids off for safety, you say no. 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 Anyway, that's it for me. I am out of here. We'll be back next week with another great panel and another great interview. Hope you guys have a great week, and I will see you next time. Well, I won't actually see you, because this is a podcast, and I'm recording it, you know, ahead of time, and then you guys hear it, like, a couple days later. So, you know, the whole seeing thing, it's just a bad turn of phrase. Sorry about that. I'm leaving now. Bye.